Welcome to Conversationalist with Sue Sips. This is, once again, a half-a-sip episode because Rania isn't here with me, but that won't be a problem at all because today we will be joined by a super cool guest whom I will let introduce himself in a bit. We met at my current workplace 9 months back, eight to nine months back, when we were both new joiners and quickly bonded over our third culture kid background. Although his is much more complicated, which you will come to learn. So without further ado, please welcome Max. Yay.
Hey guys, and hey Dea, thank you so much for having me on this podcast.
No, thank you for willing to come on this podcast.
Of course, my pleasure.
So this is one of my like favorite facts about Max, is that his name is literally an amalgamation of like all the cultures in your blood. So would you introduce yourself, Max?
Sure, yes. So most people call me Max, but my full name is actually Massimiliano Di Cara Hassan, and some of those names actually have no reason to even have those names for blood reasons. They just happen to be arbitrarily thrown at me. So Massimiliano is actually an Italian name, and I was given that name because my mom's best friend growing up was an Argentinian woman of Italian descent, and she's actually the one who gave me that name.
Oh.
And then Di Cara is actually an Indonesian name that's short for Dia Ada Karna Asmara, which is really corny. It means he exists because of love.
I was going to say sweet.
Yeah, or sweet. He exists because he's sweet. And then Hassan is just a very standard Indonesian of Arabic descent name.
So where were you born and like how have you been living your life this past?
Lots of movement. I was actually born just outside of New York, technically New Jersey, but us folks from New Jersey like to say just outside of New York, so we don't have to disclose the fact that we were born in New Jersey. And that was actually because at the time my dad was working at the UN, and most people who are familiar with the UN know that they don't pay high salaries, so that's why we had to live in the New Jersey side, because we couldn't afford to live in the New York side. So I was there for the first 3 years of my life. I was born there, as well as my brother, and then by virtue of being born in the U.S., I have a U.S. passport. After about 3 years or so of me living there, we moved back to Jakarta, so this is about 1995.
Mm-hmm.
And actually back then, in Jakarta in 1995, just in general during the 90s, mid to late 90s, it was actually like a pretty big boom for the expat community. So like I went to an international school. Went to a couple first, actually. So I went to Global Jaya. I went to a local school at first, but it didn't work out because people made fun of me for eating bread instead of rice. Tarakanita, actually.
But could you speak Bahasa back then?
Yes. My parents both spoke Bahasa to me.
Yeah.
And then I ended up at an international school called Chita Buana. Mm-hmm. And like all my classmates were basically either American or Australian, German, and then a lot of mixed race Indonesian kids. And there was a lot of folks from like the oil boom. I guess there was like a big investment in oil rigs back then. So there's tons of expat community around that. Lots of other third culture kids from that era. Then obviously the Asian financial crisis hit, and I actually was evacuated with a lot of the other expatriate community. However, I was during the latter part of the evacuation. So most people who are familiar with the evacuation of the Asian financial crisis know that most of the expat community relocated to Singapore, but Singapore is a small country and they only were accepting up to a certain quota. And so I actually ended up in Kuala Lumpur, where I lived for 3 or 4 months. Well, then I came back to Indonesia after the 3 to 4 month period in KL, lived here for another couple of years. And then for middle school, I actually relocated to Singapore. And then I moved to San Diego for my high school. And fun fact, the reason I moved to San Diego is because while I was in Singapore, my dad was working for not really a BUMN company, and BUMN is state-owned enterprise. It was actually more like a contracting company that worked with BUMN companies.
Okay.
And he was just getting very, I guess, fed up with the bureaucracy. And he had this entrepreneurial zeal that he wanted to explore further. So he had a crazy idea. It was just, I'm going to start a coffee shop, an Indonesian-themed coffee shop in San Diego. And he just seized that opportunity, and he did it. And that's why I ended up in San Diego.
Oh, so wait, so your entire family moved
We uprooted in Singapore and moved to California.
Okay. I was under the impression that you and your brother moved there for school.
Entire family, including my mom.
And you've lived there ever since.
I moved to the East Coast, Boston, for college. Was there for another 4 years, and then grad school was in Michigan for about a year. And then I was working in the San Francisco Bay Area for the last three years, yeah.
When you're talking about yourself, like, what do you identify yourself as mostly? You would say that you're culturally more American.
Probably. This is actually something that I struggled with a lot growing up, because when I was in Indonesia as a kid, people were always like, oh, bule.
Yeah.
But I had only up until that point, like, really had only a memory of living in Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because when I was in New Jersey, I was like barely a toddler.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Then I think when I moved to the U.S. for the first time, especially specifically California, that was when I fully kind of realized, oh wow, I somehow, even though I've never like lived in this place before, I fully identify with this way of thinking.
Yeah.
And it's kind of that way of thinking. The way I describe it is being very progressive, being very open, being very kind of multicultural in your way of thinking, rather than being like anchoring yourself to any particular identity. I think Californians are, I mean, just by virtue of California being a very diverse state, right? There's no singular Californian identity, and it's a pretty like flexible, I guess, label. I definitely identify more as being Californian, but one of the important things is being a Californian doesn't necessarily mean that you can't be anything else, right? Like, go surfing in the morning and eat gado gado in the afternoon, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think it was until I moved to California that I found comfort in that kind of dual identity.
Because for me, it was slightly different. Since I moved out when I was in middle school, so I was moving away from home because Indonesia has always been my home. And it was a different case with my siblings because they were much younger. Qatar has a lot of expats as well, but perhaps it's also due to our parents being more of the conservative Indonesians. They do hang out with the Indonesians.
I see.
Yeah, it's very different from some of the friends I have whose parents have lived abroad, like have lived somewhere else before. They, like, the group of friends are different. So that did affect who we became friends with in the end, who we hung out with. Have you ever felt like you lost your connection with Indonesia?
Yeah, I think when I was spending more and more time in the U.S., I mean, obviously I would still do my annual trips back to Jakarta to visit. My entire extended family lives in Jakarta.
So I'd
always come back pretty much during like the Christmas time, New Year's Eve time, back to Jakarta to visit them.
Oh, so you visited quite often.
Every year, every single year since I left. So yeah, ever since, you know, moving away from the age of like 12-ish. So, I mean, I've always had that connection, albeit you could argue it's a loose connection. But I mean, having, you know, two parents that are originally from Indonesia, having my whole family here, there's always like that identity in the back of your head. And I think the longer and longer I was in the US, the more and more I felt like disconnected from it. And I was still nurturing this interest, like in other ways. Like I didn't fully minor in it, but I actually was doing a lot of studies in Indonesian anthropology, Indonesian economics, Indonesian politics, etc. I actually wrote my thesis on the Indonesian economy because I was so interested in it. And so I was always kind of nurturing that interest in different ways, but obviously it's not the same as like, you know, living here as an adult.
Yeah.
And I've always felt in the back of my head that I would eventually come back to Indonesia in some capacity to basically work in, I mean, my career interest is financial inclusion, so to work in the area of financial inclusion. I just didn't know what that kind of looked like concretely. So that interest was always there. And I think, you know, in terms of the timing of when I was working in Silicon Valley in financial inclusion there and learning a lot of new things about how financial services are conducted to the bottom of the pyramid and getting a better understanding of, hey, how I might apply some of these principles in Indonesia, that was a really good timing for, you know, Ben to reach out to me, you know, ask me whether I would actually be interested in coming back.
Did that interest arise from a particular, like, I don't know, maybe an encounter with, what was it, with financial inclusion? Or did you always just think that you were going to come back?
Yeah, so first of all, for context, I think that there's a pretty large, like, Indonesian diaspora that has no interest coming back home.
Yes, I agree.
For whatever reason. Right, there's so many different reasons. I have a lot of friends who, unfortunately, they have Indonesian passports, so they're beholden to the visa system.
Yep.
And a few of them, like, are unlucky and, you know, basically could not renew their visas and had to come back home, but it wasn't because of their choice, it was because of just the circumstance.
Yes.
And I know a lot of folks with that same kind of thinking, like, I, you know, if I have the choice, I'm not staying in Indonesia.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think for a lot of those folks, there's a lot of different reasons floating around. One generalizable one is a lot of these kids left during the 98 Asian financial crisis, right?
Mm-hmm.
And their last memory of Jakarta is not a very good one, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Not to mention a lot of these are Chinese Indonesians. So they were in particularly hit hardest during the Asian financial crisis, and that is even more fuel to the fire as to why they want to come back. There's a lot of Indonesians who will go to great lengths
yes,
to avoid coming home.
To avoid coming home.
I think I'm probably part of a minority of overseas Indonesians who actually had a strong desire to come back home despite, you know, the different lifestyle and all the challenges that come with moving back. I think Gojek, frankly speaking, is probably like one of a handful of places I could even imagine working in,
mm-hmm.
in Indonesia. Like if I had to work at like a BUMN company, then I probably wouldn't survive, for example. And there's actually there's a handful of folks like me also in Gojek, right? Like Crystal kind of falls into that category. Actually, hers is even more extreme because she literally never lived in Indonesia.
Yeah, actually.
Which is kind of crazy. But then like even, you know, JB and Corp Strat and even Peter and Gopay, like they all kind of have that same like pulang kampung, coming back home story. I can't speak for their cases, but for me personally, I think one reason that I held that conviction was because of the way that I was raised. My family is very atypical in an Indonesian lens. I mean, even for a Western lens, they're very atypical. So for context, my parents now run a co-working space, among other things.
Mm-hmm.
My mom also works for Facebook Indonesia, and my dad also has lots of different side projects. He has his own hotel in Bali, and he also is a bike tour guide. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So they're just very atypical. You could say they're, you know, basically like millennials, but 50-something years old in a way.
So millennials.
Yeah. It's almost like instead of, you know, them going through a midlife crisis and like buying a sports car and like going on a cruise, they decided to like become millennials, right?
Yeah.
That was like their reactionary way of coping with middle age. Anyway, that's the context by which I was raised in a very atypical family. Always had very progressive values, and they always were trying to instill in Monty's my younger brother and I, this idea that you guys were born into this like place of privilege, and you should be aware of that privilege, even more so when you're living in a country like Indonesia, right? So my mom always had a yayasan that she was running. Her passion at the time was empowering women artisans. She actually worked with female artisans in all around Java, actually, but mostly in Jogja, to basically create a export market for their bags.
That's really great.
She worked with a lot of these,
she's been working on it for...
And a lot of these women are, like, you know, marginalized women, like, maybe they're their head of household, or maybe they're widows, etc. And she would work with them to create export markets, you know, send their bags overseas, sell them in the U.S. or in Europe or whatnot.
Oh, that's so cool.
And in addition to other things, she was also, like, working and volunteering at orphanages and whatnot. So my mom was always, like, this kind of staunch social worker.
Mm-hmm.
And then my dad was always very much about, like, heritage and culture, despite him being, like, from a very weird background. So for context, my dad is half Achenese and half Czech. So my dad always was very in tune with like kind of being
like his cultural
being
values,
true to one's culture, being true to one's values. I think I was always hyper aware, like, okay, yes, maybe in terms of my value system and whatnot, I identify more closely as an American.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to my blood, when it comes to my heritage, I'm fundamentally an Indonesian.
Mm-hmm.
And then by virtue of my mom raising me with these lots of strong social values, as an Indonesian, I feel obligated to give back to Indonesia and do something with my career that
mm-hmm.
can service those needs of those other people that are not as privileged as I am. Throughout my career and throughout both academic and professional career, this kind of took different shapes.
Right,
so like
okay.
First, when I was studying, I actually interned at Habitat for Humanity. That was actually my first like NGO job. Long story short, that project completely failed. Because when you put a bunch of like former NGO people, well, current NGO people, in charge of managing a portfolio, like a lot of them don't have that skill set.
Right.
Right. They just are not aware of like, what is risk management? What is underwriting? Like, what
is any of that, right?
I'm so used to just like identifying, you know, disaster struck communities and giving them housing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to like manage repayments. So that was like the first foray into like, I guess me questioning, okay, well, I do want to help others and I want to empower others. Is NGO really like the best lens for that?
Yep.
And then the following summer after that, I actually thought, okay, well, you know, maybe, you know, this is an NGO that's too localized and too small and too specialized and they don't have the right resources. Maybe I need to go like a level above.
Yeah.
So I actually interned at the WTO in Switzerland.
Ooh.
And I hated it. It was the worst thing ever because they don't really have the right enforcement mechanisms.
Right.
So the WTO can see, for example, I particularly was actually working with the East African countries on kind of lobbying the WTO for their agenda. Like, for example, one of the countries I was working with was Kenya. And Kenya had a strong interest in like improving or removing barriers to trade for agriculture because they had, you know, a lot of maize and rice that they wanted to export, a lot of coffee they wanted to export. And there was some countries that had protective tariffs, right? And obviously, when you're a small country like Kenya and you're trying to sell into big markets in Europe or North America, there's a lot of barriers to trade that already exist even without having those official barriers to trade. So basically, I was trying to help these countries to, like, lobby the WTO to kind of like be trade assistance in a way.
Ooh,
and the thing you have to realize is that all you can really do is, you know, you're in this big room, everybody's kind of like there passively and you can make your case passionately, but then when it comes to like actually getting things done, nothing happens. Like
that's
just the truth. It's like almost like this room that people are just complaining and nothing happens. So that was my other exposure to kind of like this, okay, I want to make a social impact, but maybe this is not the right lens or method to do it. So then I started thinking, okay, I believe that financial inclusion is probably the most impactful way that I can impact people's lives and basically empower folks to, you know, get a leg up. How do I achieve that? And so I decided the only right way to do that was to go the business route, right? Because every model has to be a sustainable model for it to scale and for it to make economic sense.
Yeah.
So I actually ended up going to business school. I realized I actually need to learn real skills before I can pursue my career goal.
Yeah.
So.
But you knew what cause you cared about.
Yes. But the thing is, I was so fortunate to have the space to explore and to figure out what I did and didn't like. What are the models that I don't see eye to eye with, for
example. Yes, that is very true.
Right? So going to business school, learning hard skills like finance and operations research and analytics, and then applying those in Silicon Valley. I had my first job out of grad school was at Oracle, which is a big data company, and picking up, you know, SQL and big data management, etc. That set the foundation for me to like fully express like how I was going to pursue my career, my career North Star, if you will, financial inclusion. That's when I ended up at Kiva. Further honed my skills there, learned a ton over there, built a really good network. That's actually how I met Ben. And then worked at Opportune, which is another fintech that is working on financial inclusion matters, specifically for recent immigrants in the US. And it was within that scope that I realized, okay, I've picked up enough.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I'm not an expert in this yet, but I picked up enough that I now feel like I can go back to Indonesia with this value system that my parents instilled in me, with this knowledge of methodologically how am I going to tackle what I'm passionate about, and bringing all that back to Indonesia. Back to my point about how I'm in the minority of people who want to do that, I think part of the reason, in addition to how I was raised, is also I think a lot of Indonesians who are abroad probably haven't found that passion yet. They haven't really felt called, air quotes, to come back to Indonesia. My hope actually is that more and more members of the Indonesian diaspora feel similarly to how I felt, because I do think that there is a lot of opportunity here. Obviously, you're somebody who feels that way as well. That's why you came here instead of, I don't know, staying in Qatar or like going to Europe or something, which you could have done. So I guess that's my long-winded answer of saying how I got to where I am today.
Yeah. I would actually like to question the passion side of things.
Yeah.
You're the type of person who sort of knew your North Star even before what form it would take. I'm in that group of people who thought they knew, but then as I went along and tried a bunch of different things, I realized that, oh, it's this is what I maybe college me was interested in. But now that I'm actually in the industry and working with a lot of the people, I like that one better. So I think out of school, it was a lot of also exploring. And you're absolutely right that I had the privilege to explore and not everyone has that choice. What I saw from my dad's experience, at least, is that he obviously grew up here, went to school here, and then he went abroad for work. And what I was sort of jealous of was his network in Indonesia. And so that whenever he came back and he wanted help, he would always have that. And I think I wanted that strong network because I wasn't convinced that I could make something as strong, a network as strong, if I were to go outside. You know, with like my social skills back then and all that. That was my goal. Instead of passion, it was like fast network in a lot of the industries. So I didn't want to just focus on one. Like I could have just stuck to consumer goods and that was it.
Yeah.
But no, I tried Gojek first and then I went to consumer goods and I went back here. I'm also actually part-timing for a publishing company, Gramedia, if you know.
Yeah,
KPG.
Yeah.
I have friends there too. Well, I'm exploring support group for mental health sufferers. So that was my goal of coming back. I've been trying to reframe my question. The question I ask myself instead of what's your passion is what you want to learn, like what skill sets are you actually trying to build? That's the first one. And second is what do you not mind sacrificing? For me, I know that by staying here in Gojek and by staying here in Indonesia, I'm sacrificing the opportunity to go outside, to live with my family.
So it's almost like what would you sacrifice in service of? That's what you'd consider, I guess, not passion, but maybe, I don't know, my brother calls it a greater sense of purpose. You can call it passion if you want, but that's what he refers it to.
Yeah.
Because he also has that same conviction that you do. It's like, oh yeah, like I went to, because he went to USC, which is this school in LA with lots of spoiled kids, and they're all are like seeking their passion. And my brother was very much against like, oh yeah, like I don't feel like I have a certain passion about something. I actually feel like I have a greater purpose to solve this problem, which in his case is sustainability. That really drives him forward, right? That really motivates him.
Yeah, it's in the same corridor. Like, what problems do I like solving? And
what,
who are the kind of people that I like to meet and be around with?
But how does it feel on the second time around at Gojek? Because obviously when you were first here, it wasn't strong enough of a reason for you to stay here. That's why you went to a different company.
Yes.
So how is it different this time around? And what drew you back to a place that you initially left?
Yeah.
Because that's not very common.
Yeah.
I can't really think of anybody else.
I'm probably also a minority in that sense. Like, when I chose Gojek the first time, I knew that I wanted to still try consumer goods full-time because I was curious about it still. And when I was there, I knew that I liked doing research, but I didn't want to do it for that product. I don't think I wanted to do it for that industry. So we talked about why you came back and how you came to that decision. So is there any deadline you've set for yourself? How long you're going to stay here or...
My long-term goal is to take everything that I've learned about what it takes to operate in this kind of financial inclusion space and take it up to the next level, which is basically becoming an advisor and an investor. I think one of the biggest joys of my time at Kiva was being exposed to incredibly inspiring social entrepreneurs who are 10 times better than anything I could ever do, frankly. And seeing that is just a source of joy for me. Like I said already, one of my motivations for joining Gojek was like the pace of learning and accelerating my kind of growth mindset. I think for me, there's not like a, you know, it's not like, okay, it's May 24th, 2020, right? When I feel like I've stopped learning, when I feel like I've stopped learning skills towards that ultimate goal of mine, that's when I know that it'll be time to start looking.
That's fair. And I think that's how people should set, not set deadlines, but that's when you know you're ready, I guess, to move on to like the next thing or the next challenge.
Yeah.
Last message to fellow TCKs who are hesitant about returning.
Sure. So I'll answer this in two parts. First, it's very brief. It's basically, Indonesia is not the Indonesia that you think it is. It's very different nowadays. And there's no reason why you should feel uncomfortable to move back. That's my first message. Second message is more about kind of, I guess, the growth mindset I was alluding to, or finding that passion or a greater sense mm-hmm. of person, greater sense of purpose. I think it really all stems from, and I think, you know, you've already done this exceptionally well, is like, you just have to continue putting yourself out there and just being uncomfortable mm-hmm. and being okay, being comfortable with being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that, like, maybe sometimes I take for granted because, like, I was raised in a very unconventional upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always been uncomfortable and, like, you just have to cope with that. But I do feel like there's probably more people than I would like to exist that are living in comfort bubbles that they need to take out their pin and burst those comfort bubbles. Because, frankly speaking, I think having come back to Indonesia about last year and seeing all the exciting things that have been happening, I still think we're just the tip of the iceberg.
Yes. Yes. I agree completely. Well, thank you so much,
Thank you for
saying yes to my invitation. Thank you, Max.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Conversationalist with Sue Sips. Bye-bye.